Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus, and tonight I'm proud to bring you our first Living Elenismos Mythic Monsters crossover. And now I bring you to Tony Merzwicki, the host of tonight's show. Greetings, Tony. How are you?
I'm doing really well, Hercules. How are you today?
I'm doing great. Very busy. I'm learning how to use Zoom and YouTube a little better. So now I just need to learn to do simple editing, and then we'll be able to move to the next phase of our unfolding journey.
Cool. I'm really looking forward to tonight's show. We're going to be talking about the undead in Greek folklore, the Vrikolakas. And
yes.
For those who are unfamiliar with the term, I wanted to point out that modern cinema has powerfully instilled three undead kinds. There's vampires, werewolves, and zombies. The Vrikolakas of Greek folklore actually have elements of all three of these. So the term Vrikolakas is derived from the Slavic word Varkolak, which occurs in Slavic languages such as Slovak, Serbian, Lithuanian, and Romanian. And the term is actually a compound word derived from the Slavic word vilk, which means wolf, and dlaka, which means strand of hair. So it actually implies having the hair or fur of a wolf, and so thus it originally meant werewolf. The same word in the form vukadlak has come to be used in the sense of vampire in the folklore of Croatia and Montenegro, while the term vampire is more common in Bosnia and Herzegovina, Serbia and Bulgaria. So apparently the two concepts have become somewhat mixed. So while the Vrikolakas originally came from neighboring Slavic countries where vampire legends are widespread and are featured prominently in folklore, there are some important differences. In Greek folklore, the Vrikolakas are described more as cannibals than bloodsuckers, with a taste in particular for human flesh, especially the livers. So this makes them much more like contemporary zombies. So the Vrikolakas is an undead, fearsome creature that becomes more powerful the longer it is allowed to feed. Belief in the Vrikolakas was widespread in Greece, particularly in rural regions, up until the mid-20th century, but many still believe in the creature to this day.
Yes.
And we're very lucky to have Hercules, who will be able to share his expertise on the Vrikolakas. So how widespread is belief in them, in your experience?
Well, it's fairly widespread, but when dealing with Greek folklore, it's kind of it's not the whole answer. I learned long ago that Greeks have two sets of answers for things. So if I was in Limnos, for instance, where I'm from, where my family's from, I had access to all sorts of folkloric information because people knew who I was, who my family was. When I traveled to other parts of Greece and sought to gather information and nobody knew me, initially what they would tell me is the same thing that people in Limnos used to tell other people. Oh, no, nobody believes in that stuff anymore. But then when you get past that denial, when they're comfortable with you, then everyone has stories of things that happened to them personally, things that happened to people they know, and so forth. So when I was growing up, belief in these xotika, these in-between creatures, was very prevalent. And from what I can tell, the older people, at least, still believe in these things very strongly. The Vrikolakas was said to be most fierce in Santorini, just like the werewolves are said to be have been more fierce in Arcadia, and the Strigles, or witches, were most powerful in Thessaly, although they did wander around past their usual haunts. So the way that you could tell if a Vrikolakas was in the area was through pestilence and energy loss primarily. And
what exactly do you mean by energy loss?
Energy loss. Somebody would get sickly. And sometimes it was due to a disease, you know, like a plague or like an epidemic that was ravaging the area. And sometimes it would just be that certain people get sick. And the Vrikolakas tended to plague those that it was most familiar with, like its family or its village. And as in ancient times, if something like that happened, if there was an epidemic, if people were losing energy or getting sick, they would, you know, try to figure out if someone had been buried improperly.
It's interesting that you point out that they tended to afflict those that they're familiar with, because there are villages that to this day believe that the Vrikolakas will knock on the door once and will then call out to the person living inside the home. So that implies that they know them. But then if the door isn't opened, then they move next door. So to this day, there are some villages in Greece where people will never open the door after the first knock. They will wait for the second knock, and then they'll open it. Because if they open it the first time, then a few days later, the person inside will get sick, die, and turn into a Vrikolakas themselves.
One of my uncles had that custom, you know, and you knew if you went there that if you knocked the first time, they wouldn't answer. You had to wait like a few seconds or a minute and then knock again. And then, you know, they would open the door, you know, or you could hear activity that they were in there. But for you wouldn't get an answer on the first time you knocked the door.
It's interesting that with the Vrikolakas, there are these little rules about they can only knock once and they have to be invited in, because modern vampire law suggests the same thing, that they can only come in if they're invited. They can't force their way in. It's interesting that there are these laws that govern supernatural creatures.
Yes, there are. Some vampire legends have that you can confound the vampire by throwing rice in front of them. Some vampires have to count each and every kernel of rice, you know, that so that kind of stops them running water. There's all sorts of things. The cannibalism legends and eating the liver, I've heard those, but not in the, like, living accounts, you know, where people share experiences they had. With them, was mostly somebody would start getting sick, other people get, you know, sick. If it was in the family, then again, if somebody had recently died, they would see if that had something to do with it. And that would often involve digging up the grave. And if the body was still ruddy and swollen and it bled, then they'd assume that that this was a Vrikolakas, and that the Vrikolakas was bloated and bloody because he'd been feeding. So then they would either cut off the head of the Vrikolakas, or sometimes find some way of nailing the body down so that they can't get up. And they would do this either with like a big stake of wood, I guess you would call it, pointed. But it wasn't just to put in the heart and the vampire would turn to dust. Now, you nailed the vampire to the ground with a stake, you know, so it had to be something heavy to prevent them from being able to thwart it. And I've heard some accounts of them nailing the vampire or chopping the vampire into pieces, burning the pieces or scattering them. Then again, because this was something demonic, sometimes it involved priests, and sometimes it was something that was done just by family. If the rituals weren't said, the funerary rites not given in a correct way, or if somebody was buried in unhallowed ground, or if they didn't confess before they died, and you know, their soul was too evil to move on, and they kind of were stuck inside their bodies, there could have been a lot of different reasons. But that's an ancient thing, you know, because in ancient Greece too, whenever you had like poltergeist activity, you'd assume that somebody you knew was had died far away, and the funeral rites weren't held, so they would hold funeral rites in absentia for people they suspected may not be around. And if that stopped the activity, then the person was able to pass to the other side. And if it didn't, then either they had to do something else for that person or they picked the wrong person. So that all that got folded into the Bricolaca. And the dead, too, were said to be always thirsty for blood. And an example of this is when Odisea went to Avi, and he wanted to talk to those who had passed. He brought blood and sacrificed in the underworld, and the blood allowed the shades who were in the Asphodel fields and bereft of memory to remember and to speak.
That's actually the first account of the necromancy in Greek literature occurs in Homer. And as a result of that, there were people in later years who believed that Homer had been a practicing magician because he revealed a technique of necromancy.
That's a possibility, but those beliefs too, they're pretty common in the folk lore. So it could just be that he grew up someplace where they conveyed information to people more freely. There was some information, I think I've talked about this on other shows, and I've written about it in one of the anthologies I wrote in, that some information could only be passed on under special circumstances. Like some information could only be passed on to a woman. And it had to be during the time that the person was dying or other special conditions had to be met. So a lot of information was lost that way.
Wow.
Because you don't know, you're not able to control when you're dying.
Exactly. You mentioned that you'd spoken to a number of older people while you were a young man who had experiences with the Bricolacas. My knowledge of the Bricolacas is limited to what I've read, so I'd love to hear some of those anecdotes.
It was just suspicion of the Bricolacas. Usually the story went that there was sickness, and either a particular family was afflicted or an area was afflicted. And sometimes there was like the weird knockings at the door, like poltergeist activity, sometimes somebody calling out names. And that too, that's very typical of ghost infestations. You know, I've investigated lots of hauntings, and that seems to be a common feature. But it was a sickness that was brought that led people to believe that it might be a Bricolacas. So then again, it's like, who died recently? And the assumption is if they're knocking on particular doors and if they're calling out particular names, like you pointed out, they knew the people there. Greek villages, everybody knows everybody's business. So it's not a long process. Who died recently? And then go dig up the grave. And this is done traditionally, depending on which region in Greece you are, it's done after a period of time, sometimes a year. I don't remember those customs in great detail, but the bodies are exhumed anyway, and then the bones are washed, and they're kept inside like a separate room, because Greece is very old, and if you left the bones and bodies in the ground, you'd run out of space to bury your dead in. And some of these settlements that are around today have been around for like hundreds, if not thousands of years. So they take out the bones, they wash them, and they put them in buildings, in like crypts. So if the Bricolacas was afflicting your area, you would, they would dig up the grave. And if the person had not decayed, then there was a suspicion that there were Bricolacas. And then the next thing is, can they bleed? And then if they bled, that kind of confirmed it. And then depending on what village you were in, the procedure would be different. Sometimes it would involve the priest. Sometimes it would just be the family. But kind of everybody knew what to do if you know, there was a Bricolaca. And in the lore, these seem to happen most in Santorini. And some anthropologists, I remember, speculated that maybe there was something in the soil of Santorini that prevented the decay or slowed down decay considerably. And that's what fed these legends about vampires in Santorini.
Interesting. While you were talking, I had this really weird thought. I grew up Catholic, And one of the signs of sainthood was you open up the crypt and the body of the saint is undecayed. So
right.
I can imagine Greek villagers seeing the body of a saint and saying, oh, that's a Vrikolakos, it's not a saint. So, perception has a lot to do with things, yeah.
But your family rarely thinks of you as a saint. And many times they remember and point the finger for the bad things in life. So I would imagine for many families, somebody not having rotted in the ground would bring up bad reasons rather than good reasons why that may be so.
Yeah, absolutely. So what are the ways that someone can become a Vrikolakas? We've already discussed the possibility of opening your door after the first knock. What other techniques could result in the creation of a Vrikolakas that you're aware of?
If you succumb to the sickness that the Vrikolakas brings and die, you stand a good chance of being a Vrikolakas. Oddly, if you have red hair, you stand a very great chance of becoming a Vrikolakas when you die. If you're engaged in diabolical or unholy practices, you might become a Vrikolakas when you die. In the stories that I heard in Greece, you know, regionally, you could be a werewolf and you could die and become a Vrikolakas. But the werewolf is something slightly different. It's not the same as the werewolves we have in cinema here or in our folklore. But if you're a werewolf, you can become a Vrikolakas once you've died. So those are usually the ways that you become a Vrikolakas.
Regarding the red hair, I actually read online that the reason why redheads were suspicious was because a lot of Serbians had red hair and pale eyes, and there were lots of legends of vampires coming from Serbia. So anyone who had that appearance was thought of as Serbian and hence possibly a vampire. I actually came across... You mentioned sacrilegious behavior. So there's also being excommunicated from the church and being unconsecrated ground. So apparently during World War II, Greece suffered the Great Famine. And during that time, 300,000 people starved to death. So there wasn't enough room in the cemeteries. And many people were forced to bury their loved ones outside graveyards in mass graves. So a lot of Greeks were very concerned by this, so they decapitated the bodies of their loved ones to make sure that they wouldn't become Vrikolakas, which would have to be a very difficult thing to do.
I would imagine, but again, they prepare the body in Greece, the family, and then after a year they take the body out and they wash the bones and things like that, so it's not as big a... it wouldn't be as big a thing as it might be to us in the way that we've been raised in our traditions here.
Yeah, I just couldn't imagine digging up the body of a loved one and lopping their head off. Maybe that's just me.
I guess if you suspected them of bringing plague and trying to kill everybody, then it would give you some justification for digging them up. There were other vampiric type creatures beyond the Vrikolakas. You know, the Vrikolakas were one type of creature. Then there were a bunch of succubi type creatures as well. And these were like Lamias and Empusis mostly. And then there were other things like Mormaw, and Mormaw was mostly associated with children. But they would take guises that were very sexual and appealing, and they operated the same way that the succubi did. They would like sit on your chest, and you couldn't breathe, and you'd freeze it. Your motion would be frozen at night. So they're similar to very many bedroom visitors. The Vrikolakas were said to do that too. They were said to, you know, sit on your chest and constrict your breath. Apollonius of Tyana actually dealt with a Lamia in Corinth. She was sapping energy from a young man who thought that she was his bride-to-be and was going to marry him, and she was feasting off him, and he was becoming more and more ill. So Apollonius was brought in to do his exorcisms and his magic, and he was able to dispel the Lamia.
Yeah, Apollonius's plan was a fascinating figure. His biography by Philostratus was banned by the church for hundreds of years because he lived at the same time as Jesus and performed many of the same wonders as Jesus did. And there's actually more evidence of him having existed than there is of Jesus. We have representations of Apollonius of Tyana on coins and statues. We know exactly what he looked like, whereas with Jesus, no one knows what the hell he looked like. Even though he was supposedly seen by thousands and thousands of people, there's not one contemporary representation of him. All the representations that we have of him were decades after his death.
That's very true, and I have a special fondness for Philostratus. He was a Lemnian.
Of course.
Did you know that he also wrote A Tourist Guide to Troy?
No, I haven't read that one.
Yes, it gives lie to what Schliemann and the others said about nobody knew where Troy was. Lemnians knew where Troy was. You could see Troy from Lemnos, and it was called Ilion because the sun reflected on the marble of Troy, and it looked like another sunrise. He wrote a book because Troy was like the Gettysburg during Roman times. So he wrote like a tour guide. He talked about all the different heroes that appeared to people, just like ghosts appear in Gettysburg. So,
well, the Romans had a special fondness for Troy because they believed that they were descended from the Trojans.
Yes, with Aeneas.
Yeah. There was one thing that you left out about how someone can turn into a vrikolakos, and that is by eating the flesh of a sheep that have been hurt or killed either by a wolf or a werewolf. That could start the transformation into a vrikolakos. I just came across that in my notes. Yeah,
I've learned something new.
Yeah, I just thought I'd include that for the sake of completeness.
It's important to know.
Yeah. Yeah, inquiring minds want to know.
Yes, of course. And that's how this information, like our folklore survives through our television shows. Whether you watch Supernatural or Buffy the Vampire Slayer or The X-Files, you know, you get your folklore that way. You know, in ancient times and even until fairly recently, you got it word of mouth, you know, when these stories were told, you know, at night by flickering fires and so forth. And this information continues to the present day to be conveyed in one form or another, and it blends into new forms. It's really fascinating. So now I know that if I'm in Greece, you know, it inquires to the origins of a lamb I may be eating.
Absolutely. You can never be too careful about Greek lamb.
That's right.
So apparently there are two ways to keep the vrikolakos away from you. There's garlic, which is well known to those who are steeped in vampiric lore, but there's also using the evil eye. So that doesn't just work on evil spirits, but it works on the vrikolakos as well.
Yes, that's Greeks have cure-alls, panaceas. You know, garlic is one of those magic things that can cure almost everything. Chamomile is another one of those magic things that can cure almost anything. And mountain sage, vascomilo, that's something else. You know, growing up, basically it would be the chamomilo, the vascomilo, and the garlic that you'd be given in one form or another to take care of most of your ills.
Yeah. I don't know how prevalent it is now, but at one stage the Greeks would place a small wax cross and pieces of pottery with the words Jesus Christ conquers in the grave to ward off evil. Is that something to prevent transformation into Bricolacas, or is that for something else?
Well, that's a common thing. What do you call it? Where there are doors or other like boundaries or thresholds. In antiquity, they used to put a herm, and that could be something elaborate, or it could be like a bunch of stones. And you don't want things crossing boundaries that shouldn't be there. Like, for instance, I know with Hercules, there was a you would put over the door or like over your fireplace or wherever like things can go in and out. Enthade katiki o tu dios pes kalinikos Heraklis mithenis to kokon. Herein dwells the son of Zeus, the unbeatable Hercules. Let nothing evil enter. So that continued with the Greek church. Also, like in healing centers, like Thinos in Greek, which is kind of like the Lourdes of Greece. You can still get like representations of ailing body parts, and you would bring them to the church and hang them by the icon of the saint most likely to heal you. So I don't doubt that tradition exists. People still wear the eye to reflect back Domati, the evil eye. And I remember growing up with tons of those. The evil eye was a very big thing. I remember telling people in Greece that Americans didn't believe in the evil eye, and they said that's because Americans are stupid and are spiritually blind, because anybody can see that the evil eye works. Ask anybody. Anybody can tell you that. So.
Yeah, well, the evil eye actually originally comes from ancient Egypt.
Uh-huh.
It's the eye of Horus. And it was just one of these things that presumably because it worked so well in ancient Egypt that had been adopted in the Mediterranean. So it's even used in Islamic countries. I think a lot of Islamic countries just kind of turn a blind eye to it. You get evil eye amulets coming from Turkey. So
yes.
It's just something that's tolerated, I think, although there probably are religious zealots who'd like to see them wiped out.
It's a very odd thing. You know, like when Greece was on fire about a decade ago, I don't remember exactly when it was, but just like California was burning here, Greece was burning for a period of time. And one of the things they chose to focus on was their antiquities, preserving their antiquities. I went to parochial school, which is Greek Orthodox, but we spent years learning about, not only history of ancient times, but also their beliefs and their stories. You know, so Greeks have this thing, and a lot of Greeks, including Greeks that I grew up with, and in my household, I'm Greek, there's like statuary everywhere. You can't find a free surface without some sort of mythic statuary. And this is even with devout Orthodox Christians. You know, you'll find more than enough gods in their houses and on their porches and in their gardens.
Absolutely. I was just thinking, you mentioned before that would dig up a body which they thought could be a Bricolacas, and they would nail the body down.
Yes.
That's actually a very old tradition. And apparently a tomb was found on the island of Lesbos, which dates back to the Ottoman period. And it contained a body with nails piercing through the neck, pelvis, and feet, which were pinning it to the grave. So we're talking about a practice which has endured for hundreds of years.
Right.
And I don't think any practice like that would endure as long as it has, if it didn't work.
Lesbos is the nearest island to Limnos. And right now I believe that Limnos is in the prefecture of Lesbos, so it's like right there.
Yeah. The other thing that they would do in more recent times was that they would bury a corpse face down, or they would put scythes near the grave to prevent any demons or evil spirits entering the body. And that was supposed to prevent the transformation into a Well, it says in the article that I'm reading a vampire. I'm not sure if they literally mean a vampire or a Vrykolakos. But the problem is that with a lot of modern Greeks, they just translate the term vampire into Vrykolakos.
Right.
Which leads to a little bit of confusion because, as we've discussed, the Greek Vrykolakos is a little bit different to Hollywood representations of vampires. But I think maybe in the modern Greek mind, the two concepts have become infused.
And they're based on older things, you know. They're based on with the Greek system. Even though management of the heavens and the underworld may have changed, you know, the underworld is still called Hades or Hades, the in-between creatures, you know, the daemones, you know, be they Agathi daemones or Kakodaemones, you know. Innocent daemons or bad daemons, you would translate it. They're still the same creatures. So there's still sightings of Nereides, of Satyri, of Strigles, and those follow like patterns too. Usually, as with the Nereides, are chance encounters in isolated areas.
Yeah.
And with the Strigles, and again, I've met people who claim to have witnessed this personally or it happened to somebody in their family. They'd be traveling along a mountain path at night for whatever reason, you know, they had. And then they would see, for instance, these women scantily clad dancing in the moonlight. So they would hide by a tree or rock and watch the women. And then they would notice that as clothing fell away, the women would have like a leg that was a donkey's leg.
Oh, wow.
Or that it was made of brass or, you know, something like that. And those are the Strigles, the witches. And I know that word's been used in a lot of different ways in a lot of different surrounding cultures, and it could describe a bunch of different types of exotica. But in Limnos, that's what the Strigla was. The Strigla was the woman with the donkey leg, you know, very beautiful, dancing in the moonlight. Satyri were often found, too, late at night on mountains, usually at passes, sitting on rocks. And they didn't seem to do much other than unnerve the people who encountered them. Nereides were excited and invited sexual encounters and could enslave you and enchant you. But people were still, when I was growing up and going there in the summers, people were still having these experiences and were relating them. And when I went elsewhere, they seemed to be very similar types of experiences related in other places. And I've since found a couple of folklore books that were really good. One of them was called, I believe, In the Land of Ghosts and Vampires. I still have that, but the cover fell off during years of travel. There was another one that some university published. I believe I gave it on one of the podcasts a year or two ago. Those showed me how universal these beliefs are. And again, regionally, they differ, just like the dialect differs from region to region. But the variations are very small.
Yeah. I came across a blog written by someone on Greece and vampires, and it has a list of the ways that people can become a Vrykolakos. And
okay.
I wanted to work my way through the list with you.
There are a few
here that, like, I can verify them because they're in keeping with what we've talked about. But the problem with a lot of blogs is people write a blog and they don't cite their sources.
Right.
So I was going to work my way through the list with you and just ask you for comments. Because
okay.
We're getting through very, very quickly. So the first thing she has is that those who were stillborn would return as a Vrykolakos.
I've never heard that one. And again, how would the baby get around to knock on doors and call out names and spread sickness and steal energy? That one I haven't heard. Not that it's not out there. I just haven't heard that one.
Yeah. Yeah, because to knock on people's doors, presupposes knowing those people. So if they're stillborn, they never got a chance to know anyone yet. That doesn't make sense. The next one is people conceived or born on a holy day.
That I don't think so, because if you're named on a holy day, you usually get named after that holy day. Greeks have weird rules with names. And they recycle names generationally, but also if you're born on a St. George's Day, they'd probably name you George, because there's a reason why you were born on St. George's Day. And that one, again, not that it's not a belief, but I haven't heard that one associated with Vricolakis. The only thing I can think of with the babies, with a stillborn, that it's a dangerous time between birth and baptism. And during that time, even though the child is an innocent, its soul is in peril. And that's why you need a godparent to become like a surrogate to protect the soul until baptism. So if something went wrong with that process and the soul of the stillborn, became some sort of like one of Lilith's children in Near Eastern mythology. That's the only circumstance where I could imagine a child becoming vampiric.
Interesting. I mean, I grew up Catholic, as you know, and the Catholics had these non-biblical beliefs. So one of them was the belief in a place called Limbo, which was where stillborn children would go. Not sure if that includes unbaptized children as well, but definitely stillborn children would go there. At least with the idea of purgatory, there are a couple of biblical quotes which kind of suggest its existence. But, I mean, there's nothing for limbo that I'm aware of. The other thing is you mentioned that if people were born on a particular holy day, that you should be named after that particular saint.
Right.
I can relate to that because in my case, my mother named me after St. Anthony of Padua. So for Catholics in Europe, we would celebrate the feast days of our saints more so than birthdays.
In Greece,
so, yeah, because I was born in Australia, we would celebrate my birthday, but we'd also celebrate the feast day of St. Anthony of Padua, which was June the 13th as well. So it was like, yay, two lots of presents. Yeah, I wasn't complaining.
Yeah, my Greek given name, the day of the celebration happens to fall near the festival of Hercules Invictus, which is,
okay.
Yes. Yeah, so there's a complex system of reasons that got woven into my decision to, you know, de-Greek and de-Americanize the names I was given here and to go back to that. But yeah, in Greece, the name day is more important than the birthday. It's just like January 6th is more important than Christmas. But again, birthdays are celebrated in December 25th because the rest of the world pretty much accepts that as Christmas. That's here to also know.
You know, to be honest, if there wasn't a complex system that took you from your given name to Hercules, I would have been disappointed. I kind of expect a complex system from you. I say that in the most loving, caring, sharing way possible, as you know.
Since you're friends, I'll share that with you offline.
Okay. Excuse me, I've still got that cold. The third category that she has is those that ate the flesh of an animal that wasn't properly killed. That's kind of reminiscent of eating lamb meat that had been injured by either a wolf or a werewolf. But she seems to be treating it as something broader than that.
Yeah, that one, again, that one I haven't heard. Doesn't mean that somewhere in Greece people didn't believe that, but I, that that's
yeah.
I, the food thing I haven't heard.
Yeah, So the next one is people that didn't receive a proper burial. That's something that we have discussed, and
yes,
that is something that definitely causes. You're going to love this category because they were hated by the Greeks. So they can turn into a wooden Holocaust.
I haven't heard that specifically about any particular group of people. And they had strong feelings that were against the Turks. I grew up with many stories about Turks, but I've never heard a story associating Turks with Bricolacus or actual demons. They were human people that the Greeks didn't like.
Yeah. The next one is those that died living sinful lives.
Yeah, that would fit in.
But technically, everyone leads a sinful life. You know, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God.
So right. If you haven't confessed, if you're not forgiven, through what rituals exist in the church or in whatever your system of beliefs, then you have that on you. And the ancient Greeks, and to some extent even modern Greeks, miasma, pollution, it does count, and it does affect you, and it affects other people.
That actually ties in with the Catholic idea of the last rites,
mm-hmm.
where it's not Catholic to die quickly. You're supposed to die in agony to give time for a priest to come to you and take your last confession. So the idea is that you're pristine and pure, you've had all your sins forgiven, and then you die in a state of grace.
Yeah, if you got those rituals, then you'd make it. But if you didn't get those rituals, then you might be stuck in between, in the in-between worlds for one reason or another. In antiquity, that was solved through use of coins on the eyes and other such things. And in more modern Greece, it's the confession and these death rituals or before death rituals. And also in the Greek Orthodox tradition, you pray at certain points during the funeral. You also pray like 40 days after, and then you have memorials.
Yeah.
And these are all for the deceased.
Yeah. So the next category is those that practice witchcraft during life.
That would fit with the beliefs I grew up with.
Yeah. Those under excommunication by the church.
That would fit in.
That definitely is, because we've come across that before. Here's an interesting one. Those that had sex with animals.
That I don't think so, because it was a very shocking thing. Whenever I would travel around in very, very rural areas that were mountainous, a lot of the young men would be there drinking at the cafenia, boasting about the farm animals that they had relations with. So I don't think if they feared becoming vampires, they'd be broadcasting or bragging about their exploits.
I don't really think of that as an exploit, but hey, that's just me.
Well, it's they live in a country that was very repressive regarding sex. So
okay.
So basically, their options are very limited. Another way they seek release is by redefining what certain terms might mean. But again, that's a topic for a whole other show.
Absolutely. And the same thing happens in Islamic countries, because females are off limits until they're married. Young men have to get by either with other young men or with farm animals.
Or with
anyway.
That's a topic for that's a whole other topic for a whole other show. But yeah, I don't see that happening because I don't know how common it is. But in my travels, I heard many. I understand and speak Greek, so I heard many such conversations. So I know that it's not uncommon.
Okay, here's an interesting one: a corpse that had an animal jump over it before burial would return as a Vrikolakos.
I haven't heard that one.
So it presupposes that somehow having an animal jump over a corpse before it's properly interred would make it, would defile it in some way?
I would imagine so. If that animal was considered unholy or suspect in some way. I know that in death, like for instance, what a lot of people don't know is that you still have ancient gods escorting you to the world you go to when you leave this world. And in ancient times, it was Hermes. Now it's Charon. He's called Charos, though, and Thanatos himself. So these are two of the personages who come and escort certain people to the other world. And then there's a big black bird. And the big black bird is something that, again, people swear that they'll relate the stories about somebody dying in their house and everybody heard the big bird and, you know, or saw the big bird or the big bird thumped into the window or, you know. So I imagine that there might be some animals that might make you unclean and therefore you wouldn't make it to the other world. But I haven't heard it personally, that story.
Hmm. Like I said, I'm just running these past you because they're totally unsourced. So I just thought it'd be interesting to discuss. I mean, this is like a fireside chat. So we're like you and me getting together, chewing the breeze, but hopefully anyone listening is enjoying this as well. So the next one is those that died of the plague or some unknown disease. That ties
that
in with what
sense.
You said earlier on.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, the Vrikotakas was thought of as bringing some sort of disease. So it seems like the author of the few that are definitely true and somehow sourced some others, either she made them up or channeled them or who knows where it's come from. Okay, so there's two more. The next one is being a prostitute or having sex with a foreigner.
I haven't heard that one, and again, again, these things might not be true today in Greece. I'm in my 60s. We're going back to the Greece of my youth, you know, so the reality there might be extremely different now in terms of these things. But back in the day, prostitutes were not considered unholy. In fact, if a father could afford it when the son became of age, he would pay a prostitute or a widow who, you know, and everyone knew who the widows, which widows were receptive to this, have sex with the son and make him a man. So, again, the belief might be different elsewhere or a different time, but when I was growing up and listening to all these stories and hearing all these conversations, that one never came up. And also in a land that... again, has restrictive customs in terms of interactions between young men and women. The fantasy of a lot of the village kids who were guys was to find some tourists, where they had different beliefs about sex and have sex with tourists. So I don't think, at least when I was growing up, that particular belief was something to cause fear. You know, it was actually an advantage to go to a prostitute or have sex with a tourist.
I had a Greek colleague many, many years ago, and he came from one of the islands, and this is so long ago, I can't remember which island it was, but he told me that it was considered wrong to masturbate, but it was considered right to save up money and see prostitutes.
Yes, that would be correct. That on the scale of sins, we call it masturbation would be higher on the severity scale than going to a prostitute.
Wow. Okay. So, I mean, that's one of these little bits of information I've sort of filed away for years, and I've never really mentioned it to anyone, and I just kind of came out, and you've verified it.
Well, I'm honored that... I was able to verify a strange belief.
Okay, so the last one is people that were unpleasant during life. Well, that means just about everyone who's on social media. So I can't believe that that's true.
So it's a Vrikolakis apocalypse that's coming.
Yes.
Well, I haven't heard that one, but I know that if someone was not liked, they would probably be suspected. If someone was not liked universally or had died, then they would be high on the suspects list of being a Vrikolakis if there was some sort of a reason to suspect a Vrikolakis. But I've never heard that the unpleasantness itself, you know, because again, people are very gruff, especially in rural areas. So I can't see that as qualifying somebody to become, you know, an undead monster.
But just running with your thoughts, if you have some sort of activity happening in a village which suggests the existence of a Vrikolakis, you don't want someone you liked being dug up. You'd rather have someone you don't like being dug up first. So you'd be pointing at Stavros. Well, I never liked Stavros. You know, let's dig up his body and check it out. So you want to make sure everyone else's body is checked out before your friends.
Right. And then you'd remember the time Stavros ate that suspicious lamb.
Yes. He was always eating suspicious-looking lamb. Definitely Stavro.
There you go.
Well, that's the list. And then the woman adds, yay, the old Greeks had a million and one ways a person could turn into a vampire. It was most definitely a country that believed fully in vampires and lived in fear for it. I mean, I can't accept that because that would imply that there'd be more vampires than anything else in Greece, and that's clearly not the case.
Right.
But again, she
didn't source where she got the material. But again, there are a lot of customs about a lot of different things, a lot of different beliefs about things in Greece, and these things might exist in other parts of Greece and just not in the Limnos that I experienced decades ago. So again, we don't know.
Yeah. So we're starting to run out of time. I just wanted to get some of your thoughts on when you compare the legends of the Vrikolakis to what you see in Hollywood movies. What sort of feelings do you have?
Well, they're not. My wife actually found a couple of movies that were about Vrikolakis. There was something called Island of the Dead in 1945. And
they
called the vampire a Vorvolaka, which is probably like a variation of Vrikolaka. Again, the deaths were a result of a plague. That was a suspicion, or was it a Vorvolaka? She said that. You want me to read you what she said, or?
Yeah, please.
On a Greek island during the 1912 war, several people were trapped by quarantine for the plague. If that wasn't enough to worry about, one of the people, a superstitious old peasant woman, suspects one young girl of being a vampiric kind of demon called a Vorvolaka. Are the deaths the result of the plague or the Vorvolaka? According to producer Van Luten, the film was inspired by the painting The Island of the Dead by Arnold Böcklin. 1827 to 1901, which can be seen in the opening credits. The painting also inspired the 1913 Danish film The Isle of the Dead. Vorvolakis, also called Vrikolakis, occurs in Greek folklore as an undead creature capable of causing harm to the living. Its characteristics are similar to many of the characteristics of legend, but it's most closely associated with vampires. In Hollywood movies such as Dracula, 1931, the word vampire is often translated to Greek in Greek as Vrikolakis. However, traditional Vorvolakis, Vrikolakis are not noted for blood drinking. They are flesh or liver eaters and have traits similar to zombies or werewolves. In Greece, a person could become a Vrikolakis after death due to a sacrilegious way of life excommunication, a brutal and unconsecrated, a burial in unconsecrated ground, or eating the meat of a sheep. Oh, she found the sheep too, which had been wounded by a wolf or a werewolf. Yeah, she said that she prepared, if we got into talking about movies, she said send me an email. So while you were talking, I brought it up. So there you go.
Wow, that's so cool. Oh, and the other thing is, with the Isle of the Dead, H.R. Giger produced his version of the painting as well. I'm a mad H.R. Giger fan, yeah.
I like Giger too.
Very evocative and dark.
I have to look that up. And she had also said that there was another film where somebody, but again, she didn't send it in this email. She was talking about it before it came up for the show. That there was another film, and I don't remember the name, where there was a count who became a vampire, and he was killed in Greece. So, but other than being killed and becoming a vampire in Greece, there was no other element of folklore or anything that contributed to vampire lore in any way in the film. So,
interesting. Well. Is there anything we've left out? We've got like 4 minutes to go.
I don't think so. This is a living tradition, and the folklore, as you said, was imported from elsewhere and mixed in to what was already there to give birth to new traditions and new esoteric lore. And I think we did a pretty good job of covering it. I'm going to be holding a panel on vampires sometime in January. So I will invite you. If you're interested, you'd be welcome to participate. This will be a Zoom thing. When I was investigating the paranormal more actively a couple of decades ago, I investigated the vampire subculture in New York and New Jersey. And I've talked to other people who've had experiences with what they would call vampires or who've studied and know a lot of lore about vampires. So it's going to be a kind of like a vampire symposium, I guess. And just share what's known and get a bigger picture of vampires, not only in personal experience and folklore and mythology, but also in popular culture.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to have to watch that movie now, because I did come across a reference to it. And after hearing what you just read about, I'm going to watch this. Oh, the other thing that just came to me was we were talking about Apollonius of Tyana earlier on. And one of the things that he did was he drove out the plague. However, he actually found that the plague was brought by a demonic figure rather than by a Vricolacus. There is that parallel there.
It's a Lamia. Lamias were also translated as vampires when I was growing up.
Yeah.
So it was the Vricolacus, it was the Lamias, the Impusus, and then like individual type of beings like Mormor, who again focused mostly on children, and the versions of the myth that I got were very similar to Lilith and her children.
Yeah. We didn't really cover the ancient beliefs on vampires. We covered the Vricolacus, which is sort of fairly modern. Yeah, maybe we could do another show in a few months' time and look at the more ancient beliefs.
I would love that. We have 60 seconds. Can you share how people can contact you?
Facebook is always a good way, either my personal page or my my author page. And I also have a blog on Pathos called Holistic Spirituality, and I probably will write a blog on the Vricolacus, because
awesome.
I'm sort of intrigued by them. Thank you so much for sharing your knowledge, Hercules.
My pleasure, and thank you very much for suggesting this show. This is going to be the lead-in show to Mythic Monsters, so you're invited on any of those shows you care to be on. I'll just keep you posted.
Thank you so much. Have a great evening.
Okay, you too. Take care. If I don't speak with you, Happy New Year.
Yeah, Happy New Year to you and Athena.
Okay, be well, my friend. Say hi to Janet.
Be well, we'll do. Okay, take care. Bye.
Okay, good night, everybody, and Happy New Year.
Good night. Happy New Year.